It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what are you learning? We want to hear from you. We'll ask you to call in and tell us about something that you are learning how to do. You can get started right now with your answer on the Ideas Network Facebook page. First,
there has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
That was then Special Counsel Robert Mueller speaking in May. In the same speech, he announced his departure from the Justice Department. The rare public appearance came after the release of his office's report on its investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. As Mueller said, if he were called to testify before Congress, he wouldn't say anything that goes beyond what's already in the report. We're going to see if that's true. Mueller is set to testify before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees tomorrow. Devlin Barrett reports on national security for The Washington Post. Devlin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Are we going to hear anything from Robert Mueller that we haven't already heard? What are the hopes and fears, I guess, of both parties in the House?
I think the chances that Robert Mueller offers some new piece of evidence or some new detail about the investigation is pretty small. I think he's sent every signal he possibly can to say that's not going to happen. You know, but I think Democrats still hope that just the simple act of him saying on live television the basics of what is in the report might be compelling, might convince some members of the public that this is pretty serious stuff. But look, I think on the other side, Republicans are pretty determined to challenge the whole premise of this investigation, that decided to argue that this is all was all, you know, sort of a flawed investigation from the start, and that this whole thing is worth putting to rest permanently.
That point of the idea of Mueller saying things out loud that are already in print seems like potentially a big deal. The Mueller report is long. Most people haven't read it. Apparently, a lot of members of Congress haven't read it. Hearing out loud, some of the material in there could be still a surprise to some members of the public, couldn't it?
I think the part of the issue is that Mueller carries a lot of gravitas. For a person who almost never speaks publicly, at least in this day and age, you know, when he does speak, it really does, so far, it really did capture the attention when he spoke a few weeks ago. And I think that's important, and that could have sort of an impact on the political discussion that goes on in Washington. But look, honestly, I think both parties are pretty baked in terms of how they view his work. So the question is, can his words and the live testimony change anyone's minds who hasn't already decided what they believe this is about?
We're hearing reports today the Department of Justice sent Mueller a letter saying he had to stick to the report in his testimony. He couldn't go off script in some ways, couldn't talk about unindicted third parties, things like that. House Judiciary Chair Gerald Nadler called the directive arrogant, said it's part of an ongoing cover-up by the administration. So some late breaking news leading up to tomorrow's testimony there.
Yes, and even more recent developments than that. In just the last few minutes, we've seen an indication that Mueller would like one of his top deputies to be sworn as a witness, and Republicans are critical of that, and it's not clear whether that's going to actually happen. But what it tells you is that right up until the last minute, both sides are going to be jockeying for position, and there is still, you know, a little bit of tension between Mueller and his bosses at the Justice Department.
Talking to Devlin Barrett from The Washington Post about tomorrow's scheduled testimony by former Special Counsel Robert Mueller before two House committees. There have been some developments since the report itself came out, Devlin, including Attorney General Barr's memo on it, four-page memo, and then Mueller's office responding with a letter saying that memo didn't really capture the, quote, context, nature, and substance of the Special Counsel's office's work. Could that be a subject on the table tomorrow?
Yeah, I definitely expect that to come up more than once, in part because if Mueller does really stay disciplined and stick to what's already in the report, the Democrats may try to move on to other issues, like asking about whether or not the Attorney General or anyone above Mueller tried to influence Mueller's decision process or misrepresented what Mueller found. because these are tense subjects, and there have been tensions in the past on that. And I think they will definitely try to draw him out on that to see if there's any evidence of political interference or any question of whether or not Mueller believes that the attorney general put his thumb on the scale in some way.
Let's get into some of the content of the report that's likely to come up tomorrow. One of the big questions is the whole obstruction of justice charge. Mueller's team apparently felt like the president couldn't be indicted by them, so they didn't tackle the issue of criminality. They also famously didn't clear him of obstruction of justice. What do you expect to hear on that issue tomorrow?
Well, I expect Democrats will try very hard to get him to say in more clear terms what exactly that means. You know, that's been in some ways the most important part of the report, but also in some ways the least understood part of the report. And Democrats would dearly love to get him to say something about whether or not he believes the president committed a crime. I would be surprised if Mueller, you know, sort of loses his discipline and his self-control and just sort of blurt something out in answer to that. But, you know, hearings can get tense and hearings can get confrontational. So, no one can predict the future.
And then reliving the Russian side of investigations, Russian interference in the U.S. election, the report concluded that, yes, there were widespread Russian efforts to interfere in the U.S. elections in 2016. The question of collusion, people keep pointing out collusion is not really a legal term in a lot of ways. What kind of things are we going to be looking at when it comes to what kind of information the Trump campaign was seeking, what they knew, who knew what, when?
I think what a lot of folks want to have explained to them by Mueller is, what does it mean when he says that people in the Trump campaign were eager for the Russians' help, the Russians were eager to offer it, but there was no coordination or conspiracy between the two? I think he's going to get pressed on that point and asked to explain, well, if both sides want to do something and try to do something, isn't that coordination? Isn't that an agreement? And look, I think there's a lawyerly answer to that that may disappoint a lot of folks. But I do expect him to get pressed on that, because that is a central question in his entire investigation.
Now, Robert Mueller has held prominent positions in American government. He's been called to testify before Congress in the past. What do we know about him? He's obviously not somebody who relishes getting out in the limelight, or it doesn't seem that way. What do we know about him when he does appear before Congress?
We know that he really dislikes appearing in congressional hearings. We know that he really dislikes what he views as the excessive partisanship and political point scoring of congressional hearings. And, you know, in some ways, if you compare the types of hearings he sat through as an FBI director 7 or more years ago, you know, congressional hearings have gotten tougher and more confrontational since then. I expect he will bristle at confrontational approaches. But I also think his record shows that if you press him politely and respectfully, but clearly and rationally, to say more than he wants to say, he, in the past, he has sometimes started out saying, no, Senator, I can't tell you that, and then just given in and said, okay, fine, here's what happened.
Do we know anything about the format tomorrow? We've seen some of the big live dramatic congressional committee hearings lately where, okay, a Democrat gets 4 minutes or whatever, the Republican gets 4 minutes, and it's this kind of weird herky jerky thing where you don't really get an established narrative. Do we know what things are going to look like tomorrow?
It's probably going to look like that. I mean, certainly the mechanism of this will be similar to that. I think a big question in my mind going into this is, how much are we really going to be watching two hearings at once, a Republican hearing and a Democratic hearing, talking about completely different things in completely different ways? That is certainly how some of the past hearings on this whole question of Russia and the president's conduct have played out. And I think it's very possible that we could see another incidents where, at this key moment with this key witness, what actually happens is sort of a very schizophrenic approach to trying to find out information.
You know, this all started, Devlin, with the question of Russian interference in the U.S. election. Are you hearing a lot of talk in Washington about potential Russian interference in our next election?
Oh, definitely. There's a great deal of concern about it. The FBI director was just on the Hill today testifying that he was very certain that there would be continued efforts to interfere, especially in sort of the social media space. And I think that's a constant concern for government officials. But I also think that's something that the government is not greatly equipped to counter. You know, if there is, you know, greater propaganda just on the internet, the government telling you that such and such is propaganda is not necessarily a great tool to combat that. And I think what they want to do is raise public awareness so that the average American voter is just a little more cautious and thoughtful when they come across stuff online.
Devlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Devlin Barrett. He covers national security for The Washington Post. We talked to him about former special counsel Robert Mueller testifying before Congress tomorrow. You can hear that testimony. We'll have live coverage hosted by NPR on the Ideas Network starting tomorrow morning at 7:30. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Public radio listeners come from a lot of different backgrounds, places, and points of view. But one thing I think is true of pretty much everybody who listens is you like to learn stuff, no matter what age you are. So right now we want to hear from you. What new thing have you learned lately, or what do you want to learn but you haven't gotten rolling on it yet? Call in now. Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This could be book learning or how-to type stuff. Could be for career growth or just for fun. What have you learned lately? What are you learning now? Call 800-642-1234. Go right to your calls. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi.
What are you learning, Laura?
I'm learning to play the drums.
Awesome. Okay, how are you doing it?
Well, I started out by taking lessons from the local music school. I went back and forth about it, and I finally just decided I'm going to do it. And now I have expanded that to also include a lot of online learning. There's a surprising number of resources for that. And I just spend an undeserved amount of time just basically jamming to my favorite music, playing along with that. And it's incredible what it does for your mind. I had no idea, but drumming in particular is just really, really good for your brain.
I'm with you, Laura. I've been kind of teaching myself. I'm a saxophonist in rock bands, so I always assumed I could play drums. It turns out I can't, but it's a lot of fun trying. And you're right, the brain, it's just like trying to coordinate all four limbs like that. It's really a brain exercise, isn't it?
Well, it's not so much trying to coordinate them. It's trying to separate the four limbs.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that is, it's a procedure. And how coincidental, I started out as a saxophonist as well.
Wow. It's a trend. Can I ask how old you are, Laura, before I let you go?
53.
Okay. And so cool, middle age, I guess. I'm near there with you. Pretty cool doing this new thing then.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really enjoying it.
Laura, thank you so much for getting us started. We'll go now to Eva in Greendale. Eva, hi.
Hi.
Hi. What are you learning, Eva?
I am learning Korean.
Korean? What there's a lot of languages out there. What made you pick Korean?
I recently got into K-pop, and usually that's a frowned upon reason to start learning Korean. But I started listening to the music, and I fell in love with the beauty of the language and how complex it was. So I looked into it. I found an app, and some of my friends are learning it too. So I've decided to learn it from them and to use this app to challenge myself and challenge my thinking, especially over this summer.
How long have you been at it, Eva?
Only a few months, but so far it's been going very well.
And now when you listen to that Korean pop music, the K-pop music, are you starting to understand some of the lyrics yet?
A few of them. I'm starting to connect the dots sometimes. I'll see a word and say, hey, I've heard that before, and look up the lyrics and realize that I did see it.
Fantastic. Eva, before I let you go, can you tell us if we want to check out K-pop, what's a good band or artist to start with?
I would recommend BTS or Twice.
BTS or Twice. BTS I've heard of. Thank you so much, Eva. That's great. Good luck with the Korean. How about you? We're asking what you are learning, what you've learned lately, what you want to learn in the near future, what it would take to get motivated to do it. You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Mary Beth in Black River Falls. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi.
Hi. What are you learning, Mary Beth?
I am dedicating myself to learning classical Pilates. I'm approaching 60, and it's probably my fifth career change in my lifetime, but I'm very excited about it.
Oh, so you're not just learning the Pilates, you're learning to be, you said a career change. Are you going to be an instructor?
Right. Exactly.
Cool. How hard is it to do that?
Let me put it to you this way. I have done mini triathlons before, and it is way harder than that.
Okay, so that's probably not going to be my career future, it sounds like. All right. Well, how long until you're... Well, go ahead.
Well, most of the people that I do this with are in their 20s and 30s, and it's a piece of cake for them. And but I kind of think it's really a competitive advantage because I really have to learn everything in a incremental kind of building block way. It's really tough, but it's I really do want to work with people that are in their retirement and want to maintain their mobility. And so I think it's really important to be able to know exactly how to build the foundation to do it. So I'm really excited about it.
Mary Beth, thanks for calling and good luck.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Joe now with us in Fox Lake. Joe, hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am just getting ready to get back into graduate school to work on my master's in math education so I can become kind of like a mini professor.
Wow. Okay, so have you been a teacher up to this point, or is this a whole new career path for you?
I haven't. I've gotten off track, and the way I said this is I'm getting back on track for my life's work.
Now, you're a math guy, I'm guessing, Joe.
A little bit.
Okay. Now, some years back, I was like, I'm going to teach myself calculus. So I got a calculus textbook. Then I was like, I got to back up. Pre-calculus. No, trigonometry. And I worked through some of that and petered out. For those of us who don't think of ourselves as math people, you want to give us a pep talk to maybe give it another chance?
It's okay. So two things. One, there's a difference between cooking and baking. In cooking, you can just kind of throw stuff together and see how it turns out. In baking, there's an exact required recipe. There's a lot of mathematics that is like baking. It takes an exact recipe. Otherwise, it's like riding a bike. You don't get good at it the first time you jump off. Sometimes you're going to crash, and that's okay. You just got to keep going, and eventually you'll get there.
Joe, thanks a lot for calling in. Good luck in grad school. I'm a better cook than I am a baker, for sure. We are asking what you have learned, what you're learning lately, what you want to learn in the near future. You can call in at 800-642-1234. We asked on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Meg says, I'm 56 and learning to play the ukulele. I took a few lessons to get started. Now I'm going on my own. Back to your calls now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hello.
Well, I'm into three different learnings right now. First of all, I joined EAA a couple of years ago, and I'm looking forward to AirVenture at the end of the week. I want to learn more about aviation and planes. I joined a bird club a couple of years ago, bought a Birds of Wisconsin book so I can learn more about the birds of Wisconsin, and I'm also very into the history of Wisconsin right now through books and history clubs. So,
let's talk about the birding, Cindy, because that's something I'm terrible at. I'm very bad at identifying, like, you know, a flower out of groups of flowers or birds out of groups of birds, that kind of thing, unless it's like really obvious, like an eagle or a sandhill crane. Like pretty good at distinguishing those birds already?
No, that's why I'm
that's how you're learning.
I bought a bird book, so
okay.
I can have some references, but yeah, like the typical stuff we can all figure out. But there's so many different warbler species and you know, little birdies of all different song species types. I don't know half of what they are. To me, they're all sparrows, but they're really not.
That's where I am. So good luck, Cindy, with that and your other and aviation and Wisconsin history. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Brandy on the Ideas Network Facebook page. She just says she's learning knitting. So that's cool. I just don't know if I'd have the patience for that. I've tried a couple times. So far, no good. Back to your calls now. Jerry is with us in Johnson Creek. Jerry, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
What are you learning, Jerry?
Well, I've been studying Spanish for about a year and a half. I'm 70 years old, so I've got to learn real quick.
Now, how are you doing it? How are you trying to learn Spanish?
I started out just doing one online course. Now I'm doing three or four online courses. I have a tutor in Costa Rica that I talk to every week.
Cool.
I have a friend that I made, a Mexican friend that I made on Skype, and I talk to her once a week. Textbooks, storybooks, I'm doing everything I possibly can to get this language.
I'm doing it. I'm so far just been doing an app, and I turn on Univision sometimes. I'm terrible at foreign languages historically. Do you feel like you're making pretty good progress, Jerry?
I can read and write pretty well. Within my staying within my boundaries. But we took a couple of trips to Mexico last 2 years, and last year we took a bus and had to take a transfer to get where we were going, and nobody at all on the bus spoke English. We got where we were supposed to go. We didn't get lost, and I was pretty happy about that.
Muy bueno, Jerry. Good luck. Thanks.
Gracias.
Let's see, time for another caller, or maybe two. Andy is with us in Beaver Dam. Andy, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What are you learning, Andy?
I recently became an apprentice blacksmith.
Blacksmith. Okay. So what goes into that?
Well, I've always liked working with my hands, and I've been pretty good at woodworking, and I kind of wanted to expand into more permanent fixtures that wouldn't rot over time. So I kind of got into blacksmithing, and it's been really fun so far.
Okay. I'm guessing it looks hard, and I'm guessing it's even harder than it looks. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how about physically? Like, does it tire you out?
Oh, it's exhausting. Swinging a hammer when it's 90 degrees out and the forge is right next to you and that's blaring at 400 degrees minimum. It's just exhausting and just so much sweat. It's a good workout, though.
All right, Andy, thank you so much. We've heard from a bunch of people. We don't have time for everybody. Helen in Madison tells us she's learning to play African drums at age 75. Cool. We heard from Althea, who's taken a class in editing and research. How about you? Let us know what you're learning on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As part of the state budget signed into law by Governor Evers, Wisconsin's public schools are getting a $570 million boost over the next 2 years. Coming up, we'll talk with State Superintendent of Public Instruction Carolyn Stanford Taylor about how that money will be used. First, the village of Elmwood, west of Eau Claire, has a unique claim to fame as the UFO capital of Wisconsin. This weekend, residents will celebrate their history of spacecraft sightings with the 41st annual UFO Days Community Festival that kicks off, for real, on Friday. Bob Rupakis is a member of the community club that puts on the festival every year. He owns a bar in the town, and he joins us now from our studio in Eau Claire. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, talk us through the history of UFO sightings in Elmwood. It was a big thing, four decades ago or so.
You know, it really was. In the 70s, there were some very, well-documented, credible sightings. It was before my time living in the village. But one was the police chief in town who had, an experience with it. Another one was a family, a mother and three children that had another experience. And both very credible people, and the community event that we have now called UFO Days was changed to kind of honor that sightings and the history in that area.
And it's not just about the sightings. I understand the festival is a big community fundraiser for the year.
It is. It's our primary fundraiser for the community club, and we use it for all kinds of things, dances for the kids at school, Valentine's, Halloween, Christmas, Santa comes, and Easter, and all that. So the money goes to a lot of great causes.
Now, the UFO theme comes up a lot in the events. Can we, if we go to UFO Days, actually check out some of the locations where people had reported these sightings?
As a matter of fact, this is the second year we're doing this, but we do give tours that go to several of the locations where the sightings were documented. The people that give the tour, the MC as well as the bus driver, have both witnessed things firsthand. And that was my personal favorite thing I've done in UFO Days in probably 15 years was last year going on that tour, because you can often tell when someone is just telling the truth. I mean, they don't have an ulterior motive. They're not getting anything out of it. And just listening to those people tell their versions of what they saw. They saw something. They won't even say whether it was otherworldly or they can't explain it, but they both definitely saw something that give the tour, and it's impressive.
Now, you mentioned you weren't in town when the sightings happened. What did you first think when you realized, hey, you're in this community and they had this sort of UFO history?
I mathematically speaking, I have to believe that there's got to be life on other planets. So I'm not skeptical of it. My wife and I saw some weird lights one time when we lived in Ohio. We can't explain it again. Don't know if it was extraterrestrial or not, but certainly unexplainable to both of us, and we were in separate vehicles when we saw it. So I'm certainly open to the possibility that it's real.
Now, believe it or not, it seems like the community has a lot of fun, at least with the concept, right?
Oh, absolutely. Everything, you know, many UFO themes. Like this year, Culver's was very nice and donated some of their frozen custard. The proceeds are going to go directly to the Elmwood Music Group and for the school. And what we've had fun doing is naming. They haven't decided on the winners yet, but they're naming the different flavors, you know, UFO themed, like Martian Madness and other items like that. So we have a lot of fun with it and just kind of, you know, just roll with it. People really do enjoy it.
Talking about UFO days coming up this weekend in Wisconsin here in the village of Elmwood. Bob Rupakis is with us. He's a part of the community club that puts on the festival every year. Let's talk about how the UFO theme plays out in some other ways. There's a cake decorating contest.
Oh, yeah. There's all kinds of event cake decorating contests where different people get in there. There's an amateur class and a professional class. And what they do afterwards is they auction off the cakes that are brought. And then those proceeds also go into the coffers to help with our scholarship efforts and so on.
And a UFO painting class.
Yes, that's new this year. So in the food tent before full food service starts up Saturday morning, we're going to have a UFO-themed, you know, kind of a sip and paint type deal where you can sit down and they have a certain picture that you'll be guided through to paint. And at the end of the session, you get to keep the painting. So that'll be neat.
Now, there's a Miss Elmwood coronation and it's the UFO Days Court, but the winner isn't Miss UFO. Do I have that right?
No, she's called Miss Elmwood, so not Miss UFO.
Yeah, that might deter some contestants anyway.
Right, but she is out of this world, I'm sure.
Now, tell us a little bit about Elmwood as a town, as a community.
It's a great little town, 800 and some people. If depending on which way you come into town, each sign has a slightly different number as to the population, so we joke about that. You know, just a little bit of a bedroom community. A lot of the farmers that had acreage out in the countryside, as they, you know, get older and retire, they built houses in the community and go. We've noticed that, you know, it's starting to youthen up a bit in the community as, you know, people are willing to drive further for jobs. It's a nice place to kind of be in the little bit, you know, more rural lifestyle, yet still be able to get to some decent employment that's more city-based.
I don't want to get into any controversy here, but I know one or two other communities in Wisconsin point toward a history of UFO sightings and kind of try to claim at least a piece of that UFO capital of Wisconsin title. Is there a friendly rivalry?
You know, I honestly couldn't name the other towns, although I've heard the same thing. So it's certainly not contentious at all. Again, we do have fun with it. And certainly, if there were extraterrestrials, I would imagine they'd want to visit other places too.
and just give us a taste of some of the other events going on over the weekend at UFO Days.
Oh, we have, of course, the food tent, drink tent. We have tractor pulls. We have car shows. We have craft vendor sales that are on Main Street. Other food vendors, inflatables for the kids, kitty tractor pulls, parade on Sunday, you know, kind of all your town festival items that just keep people entertained. And the weather is supposed to be virtually ideal this weekend, too, so we're looking forward
good.
To that.
Yeah, that's not a sure thing this year, it seems like. Now, do you get a lot of people from out of town? I won't say off the planet, but a lot of people from out of town visiting UFO Days.
You know, we do, and not just for UFO Days, but certainly, you know, we definitely get a lot of tourism in. I've had people stop into to my establishment and come specifically to Elmwood to do their own research or just enjoyment of where the sightings, you know, took place, and it's pretty interesting.
Are there like postcards and things like that celebrating the UFO capital status?
You know, no postcards that I'm aware of, but we have all types of souvenirs at our souvenir stand that are at the during UFO Days, T-shirts and hats and things like that that you could certainly use to celebrate it.
And finally, I have to ask, I think I saw somewhere something about a UFO brat, Bob.
Oh, yeah. UFO burgers, UFO brats. We definitely run with that theme, and it serves pretty well in its 41st year. And not to put you on the spot, Rob, but what do you think of the extraterrestrial possibilities?
I have never seen a sighting that, you know, usually there's an explanation for anything I've ever seen. And, you know, sometimes in Wisconsin, I just think if there's weird lights, maybe it's, you know, EAA, right? And Appleton, like, is one of those or Oshkosh, I should say. You know, it could be just
radio
some
tower
weird
lights, I suppose.
Yeah, we've got a lot of those. Yeah. So far, no personal encounters of my own, Bob.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for coming over to our Eau Claire studio and telling us about UFO Days.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Bob Rupakis, part of the community club running the UFO Days Festival in Elmwood. Coming up, we'll talk with the superintendent of public instruction about the state of Wisconsin's public schools and the newest version of Wisconsin's budget. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As part of the state budget, Wisconsin public schools are getting more than $500 million boost over the next 2 years. Governor Evers called for a $1.4 billion increase. Republicans approved a $500 million bump. By using his partial veto power, Evers was able to tack on about another $65 million. The compromise has some school districts, including Milwaukee, saying they may have to resort to voter referenda to balance their budgets. Carolyn Stanford Taylor is the Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Superintendent Stanford Taylor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
Well, the new money, the boost in that budget, what kind of things, big picture, will it be going toward in schools around the state?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, we asked for $1.4 billion, and we were able to get movement, especially in the area of special education. Special education had been flat funded for about 10 years, and so we got almost a $500 million increase in special education. This will help districts in that districts were currently using general fund dollars to provide for special education, which, you know, are required services for our students with disabilities. So this will replenish or put additional dollars into the general fund for districts to use for all students.
Where do you see the budget as it ended up falling short?
Well, there were a number of areas. Of course, the additional dollars that we were asking for in special education, and we're pleased that the governor was able to put in some additional per pupil dollars. The other area was around mental health. We know that from our recent youth risk behavior survey, 4 out of every 10 students suffers with some kind of mental health issue, whether it's depression or suicidal thoughts. And so we got some money in our last budget around that, but we were able to get additional dollars for mental health and also for social workers in our schools. And we're appreciative to that. So over the biennium, we got an additional $12 million for those services. The other area where we had asked for dollars was in after-school programming. Our state currently does not contribute to our community learning center funds. Right now, those are federal funds. So we were asking for the state to make an investment in after-school programming, which we did not get this time around.
I want to look at concerns for schools in different settings, rural, urban, and suburban, and they all in many ways face their own challenges. Starting with rural schools, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about declining enrollment, difficulty attracting teachers to districts, the cost of keeping up facilities, even though the number of students are bringing in less money. What kind of things do you see facing rural schools in Wisconsin right now?
Well, I think it's all of those issues that you just mentioned. Right now, we have a district that's looking at dissolution, and part of that is around funding and being able to take care of all of the responsibilities of a school district. So with the infusion of the new dollars, this will take some of the pressure off the budgets for school districts. Declining enrollment is a real issue. Recruitment of educators is a real issue that not only rural districts, but other states as well as the state of Wisconsin is dealing with right now.
The opposite part of the spectrum, the biggest city in the state, Milwaukee, we're hearing from some school officials there saying they might have to resort to voter referendums to balance their budget. What are you seeing in the Milwaukee school district?
Well, the per pupil dollars will apply to every school district in the state. And so that new infusion of dollars are available for this current budget that's coming up. So by the budget being passed right now, that will allow them to know what they're getting so they'll know what their needs are beyond that.
One concern was that the governor might veto the entire budget that didn't happen. But what might that have meant for schools if we were in budget limbo for some months going into the new school year?
So that goes back to what I was just talking about, because if there were a budget veto, the school districts would have had to operate on the current funding, the funding that they had for the past year. Right now there are knowns. They know how much additional funding they'll receive.
Talking to Carolyn Stanford Taylor, Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction. One last question about the budget before we move on to kind of bigger picture education issues. Voucher schools, they've been controversial in the state. What ended up coming out in the budget when it came to state funding of voucher schools?
Well, as you know, the governor had asked to put a pause on the voucher schools just so that we could look at the funding and make sure that we're funding the voucher system as well as the public schools appropriately or adequately. And that did not pass with this budget. So things are moving as they were before. So there were no changes in that.
So here we are. The budget is passed. We're knocking on the door of a new school year. What kind of things are a priority for your office now with a new school year just around the corner?
Well, we built our budget around equity, and that's what we're looking at our agency. We know that as a state, we do well in terms of graduation and attendance and test score. But when we start to disaggregate the data, we find that there are populations of students that are not doing as well. And we want to make sure that all of our students are college and career ready so that they have what they need when they need it. And so those populations would be our students with disabilities. You saw that reflected in our budget. It would be our students of color, our English learners, and we asked for something in the budget around that. We did not get that this time around. And, of course, our students living in poverty. And this per-pupil aid will assist with that. The per-pupil aid will also assist, as I mentioned earlier, in putting dollars into the general fund, so that districts who've had to take money from the general fund to fund special education can feel that relief and are able to provide additional resources that they weren't able to in the past.
In a lot of national reports, Wisconsin as a whole and some communities in Wisconsin come out, as you were just mentioning, comes out looking pretty bad when it comes to educational outcomes and racial gaps in those. What kind of things are you working with schools, apart from the funding, what kind of things are you working with schools on to try to turn the corner on that?
Well, as you know, one of the areas that we were really concerned about and we put a concerted effort in is early childhood. And so the early beginning, our youngest learners, that's so important that we start them on the right path so that we're looking at literacy skills and early development of our youngest learners and that they come to school prepared and ready for learning. And so with the four-year-old kindergarten, we've moved that along. We're also, in some of our larger urbans, looking at three-year-old kindergarten, and they're making movement in that area. So that's one piece of it. The other, again, is around the mental health piece. We're doing a lot with social-emotional learning so that our students have those competencies, and we know that because we're teaching those skills to them. We're doing professional development with our educators around our population of students, and we know that that's changed over the years. So we want our educators prepared to teach all students. And so that would encompass all of those students that I mentioned earlier. So professional development for our educators. But we're also looking at a teacher shortage in many of our areas. So we're looking at different pathways to get people into education.
I wanted to ask you about the teacher recruitment issue. We've talked to a lot of people in schools around the state saying they're having trouble recruiting teachers, sometimes in particular subject areas. We've heard that education schools are seeing fewer people, in many cases, signing up to be teachers of the future. What's it going to take to start to turn that around?
I think part of it is we've got to to be a profession that causes people to want to be in the profession. You have to have a passion for it. And I think there are many people out there who do have that passion, but educators have been bashed so much in the recent past that we have to look at how do we elevate the profession, that we get those people who are out there who would be great in the field, interested in doing it, and taking some of the barriers out of the way for them to become educators. And as I mentioned, we're creating different pathways, maybe for someone who's been in a different career area, who's looking right now and making that shift and going into education. How do we accommodate people like that? We're looking at rural areas and working with our CESAs to provide practicums in rural areas for some of our people interested in becoming educators and providing some funding for them so that they're not bearing the cost of traveling to those areas and working in those schools.
What are your hopes when you look back, say, 5 years from now? What are your hopes for education in Wisconsin looking back from that vantage point?
What I hope for, and when I came to Wisconsin, one of the things that kept me here is because we had an excellent school system. And so I'm hoping that our schools in Wisconsin will be schools for all kids, that it won't matter where you came from, what your position was or your station in life, that we will be able to give you a great education where you graduate and you're able to do anything that you desire to do.
Do you see room for, now that the budget is done, for bipartisan cooperation on some of the more specific issues, now that the big picture's out of the way? Do you see Democrats and Republicans maybe lined up together to work on some of the things you've been talking about?
I'm very hopeful around that. And I know my commitment is to work with both Republicans and Democrats, that I'm an advocate for public education, and I'm hoping that we can put aside any of the other issues and focus on what's best for our next generation of leaders, because that's what we're creating.
And finally, looking ahead, we heard that 2018 was a record year. This is according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum for school referenda. Are you expecting to see more of those in the next go-around in 2019 and 2020?
I don't know if we'll have as many referenda as we had in the past, but looking at that, to me, that's a vote of confidence that in the community, they're supporting their public schools by saying, yes, we will dig deeper in our pockets to support public schools.
We'll leave it there. Superintendent Stanford Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good talking to you.
We've been talking to Carolyn Stanford Taylor, Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction. We talked through about the $570 million boost that public schools are getting as part of the recently signed state budget that passed the legislature and then got the governor's signature with some partial vetoes related to education spending. If you are involved in schools yourself, a teacher, administrator, student, parent, let us know what you think, what you're looking forward to, what you're worried about as, sorry kids, school is right around the corner. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can always email us ideas@WPR.org. A U.S. government auction could help you live out a lifelong dream, if your lifelong dream was to live in a lighthouse on the Great Lakes. The U.S. General Services Administration announced that auction earlier this month. There are three lighthouses up for bid here in the Midwest. Closest to home, the Superior Entry Lighthouse, located on a sandbar between Duluth and Superior. There's also the Ontonagon Lighthouse in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, just a short drive from Wisconsin. Then there's the Poe Reef Lighthouse on Lake Huron on the east coast of Michigan. If you have the winning bid, you get the building. But the Coast Guard still owns the actual lighting mechanism in case they need it to help with navigation. I dug around on the USGSA website. Here's a description of that Superior Lighthouse. an historic rectangular-shaped concrete fog signal building topped with concrete cylindrical tower 56 feet in height. Foundation encloses a basement, two-story main building with living quarters, and an integral light tower surmounted by a lantern. It is apparently white with black trim, while the main roof and lantern roof are red. Current high bid as of 2 p.m. Central Time today, $11,000. The closing date on the auction, TBD. I don't know how that works, but I know. Get your bid in right now. The Ontonagon Lighthouse, high bid is just $5,000. The one on Lake Huron, a hotter commodity at $55,000 so far. Live the dream, buy the lighthouse, invite Central Time over to hang out. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.